Evernorth Health Services, we believe costs shouldn't get in the way of life-changing care. And we're doing everything in our power to make it possible. Behavioral health solutions that also keep your projections at their best? It's possible. Pharmacy benefits that benefit your bottom line? It's possible. Complex specialty care that cares about your ROI? It's possible. Because we're already doing it. All while saving businesses billions. That's Wonder made possible. Learn more at evernorth.com/wonder.
This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Whether you're selling a little or a lot, Shopify helps you do your thing, however you cha-ching. From the launch your online shop stage, all the way to the we just hit a million orders stage. No matter what stage you're in, Shopify's there to help you grow. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/special offer, all lowercase. That's shopify.com/special offer.
Hey everybody, and welcome to the Billboard.com Pop Shop Podcast. My name is Jason Lipschutz, and I'm an associate editor and the Pop Shop blog editor of Billboard.com. Based in New York, on the other line, in Los Angeles, is the 1989 to my every other album ever in 2014, Keith Caulfield. How's it going, Keith?
I'm good. How are you?
I'm good, man. You're just towering above me. That's what I meant by that intro.
Thanks.
You're just like, compared to every other album, we're all looking up at you.
Thank you.
Come on.
And by the way, this is the one podcast that will have absolutely no news about the 2014 election.
I know, right?
Taylor Swift was elected to everything yesterday.
I know. You know, as many times as I try to turn this into a sports podcast, we are also not a political podcast. We are the Pop Shop Podcast, and we are here to talk about pop music, specifically Taylor Swift's huge sales week with 1989, biggest sales week since 2002. We'll get to that in a second. We're also going to be talking about Beyonce coming back, kind of, with her new platinum edition of Beyonce, her album, not herself, her album. The big release of the week is Calvin Harris's Motion. We're going to talk about that in the sales projection. We're also going to get to Led Zeppelin, Imagine Dragons, some CMA stuff. It's a fun week here on the Pop Shop Podcast. Are you ready to go, Keith?
Of course I am.
All right, man. Well, we had a Taylor Swift extravaganza last week, talking about 1989, talking about the album itself, the sales projection, and now the sales are final. We're not going to spend that much time on Taylor Swift this week because, you know, people, you know, might want to hear about some other artists on this podcast.
Oh, come on. Why would you want to hear about anyone else aside from Taylor Swift?
Exactly. That's the thing.
I mean, come on.
We really can't. Like, we have to start with Taylor Swift. It's the biggest sales week, like I said, since 2002. What is that final number, Keith?
1,287,000, which is just nutty. Yeah, 1.287 million copies. The biggest sales week for an album since 2002, when Eminem's The Eminem Show sold 1.322 million in its second chart week. So yeah, it's the biggest sales week for an album in over 12 years. There are so many statistics to go into. They're all up on the website, but I fear going into them because Jason will start screaming at me because I'm rattling off too many things.
How about this? What's the most astonishing statistic about this sales debut? What's the one that really was kind of like, wow, I can't believe this represents this?
Well, they're all wow, but here are some newish ones. 22% of all albums sold in America last week were Taylor Swift's 1989.
Wow.
Yeah. So
that's a good wower.
That's a good way. Yeah. Of all the albums sold in America last week, 22% of them were just this one album, 1989. Or what about this one? It's obviously the number one album on the Billboard 200 chart. It's Taylor Swift's fourth number one. But it sold so much that it actually sold more than the combined totals of numbers 2 through 107 on the Billboard 200 this week. Yeah, there you go. That's another good one. That's an interesting
statistic. I like these. Yeah. I like these. So,
one more, and then I'll stop.
Go ahead, man.
Its debut is actually more than the combined first week debuts of the last 8 albums to debut at number one. Slipknot, yeah. Blake Shelton, so she
which
sold
is pretty,
a lot.
Which is pretty crazy because you think about there's been some pretty big debuts in the past month. I mean, Jason Aldean had one of the 5 biggest of the year. Florida Georgia Line almost sold 200,000.
That tells you something right there. If he had one of the biggest debuts of the year and still it's, you know, you have to take eight of them sort of combined to get to Taylor, that just means Taylor's that huge. And overall album sales are just that cruddy.
So Keith, I want to talk about something that people need to understand, which is that when this number came out last night, and we're recording this on Wednesday, and it came out officially on Tuesday night this week, some Taylor Swift fans on Twitter were like, hey, Billboard projected like 750,000. We showed them. Ha, ha, ha. Like, kind of like
vindictively. Well, they're taking a cue from Taylor, by the way. So
sure. Oh, yeah, absolutely. She said the same thing. But can you break down a little bit how this number grew so much over the week, where it can start around where we're projecting, you know, 750,000 and then it grows by almost 500,000 copies?
Okay, let's back up just for 1 second and let's clarify what these forecasts and projections mean. We talk about them every week.
That's exactly what I want to do.
But I want to make sure that people are actually listening this time. And I don't mean that in a shady way. But most people
That was a little shady. Come on.
Most people don't read anything more than the headline, and most people don't actually listen to an entire podcast.
Wow. So, old man Keith over here.
No, it's called
shaking
truth.
Shaking his finger at the kids.
It's spilling the tea, as some might say. The forecasts that Billboard talks about are always forecasts that come from industry analysts and industry sources, meaning people at record labels who their entire job is to forecast stuff and to analyze sales. And those people share numbers with us as sources. We don't quote them. We just say sources tell us that the album could sell this much. It's all about sources from labels telling us a number that the album may or may not actually hit. Okay? So when people talk about, ooh, we showed them, well, actually, you showed the record label, because the record label was forecasting 750,000 for Taylor Swift 2 weeks ago. And the record label and other sources at other record labels all increased their projections and forecasts for the album once they saw how well it was doing in pre-orders and how well it was selling. So, you know, when we talk about forecasts, it's not Billboard making the forecasts. It is industry sources at distribution companies, at record labels, you know, multiple people at multiple places giving Billboard numbers, and then we report them. So how did that number increase? The number increased because initially the album was forecasted to do around 1.1 million, and that was like 2 months ago in its first week. And then that number was scaled back by industry forecasters, not by Billboard, once they saw how the pre-orders were doing for the album, basically. And 750,000 is a huge number, enormous, especially in 2014. But once they started to see how well Out of the Woods was doing and how that was generating pre-orders for the album, especially on iTunes, they upped the projection for the album to over 800,000. Then once the album actually went on sale, it was doing way better than anyone anticipated. And that's how daily the album forecast continually grew until we ended up with a week of 1.287 million copies.
So kids, read more than your headlines.
People, not kids. It's just people. People don't read anything.
Don't wear your pants so low. That's what we're saying, Jason.
Stop that.
I'm teasing.
You're making me sound
you're
like
right.
I'm like something. You get off, you kids. My cane is shaking in the air.
Lawn. Get off our chart lawn. No, I hear you, man. I'm just teasing you, but I think that it is important to realize that this is like anything. This is like, you know, how films do at the box office. You have initial projections based around all the factors, all the data that comes in, all the indicators. And then, you know, it's up to the people who buy tickets, and in this case, buy albums, to show what that number is eventually going to be. And that's what we report on. So,
not to diminish the concept of we showed them. I mean, frankly, the we showed them concept is a wonderful thing because you showed the industry and showed Taylor's record label and her distribution company, Big Machine, Universal Music. You showed Taylor how passionate fans are and how much they care about this album and how much they really wanted to buy it. So yeah, it is a great you showed them moment, but you know, let's not focus so much on the who showed who. It's more about, wow, this album did amazing and it's incredible how many copies that it sold in its first week.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, I guess that leads to my next question, which is, I mean, it's pretty remarkable to me that this 1989 debut was bigger than Speak Now and bigger than Red. They both sold over a million copies in its first week, but this was just slightly more, 1.279, is that the number?
1.287.
87, okay. Close enough. 1.287, bigger than Red, bigger than Speak Now. Why is that? Because you see CD sales declining year over year, and it's 2014 compared to 2010 when Speak Now came out. Was this just kind of like a perfect storm of this CD launch with the performances and Shake It Off doing so well and the whole concept of the pop album? What do you think? What's kind of getting this? What kind of got this to the point where it's the Taylor Swift's biggest album debut ever?
Well, I mean, you know, it's interesting. She doesn't have country radio anymore. And
yeah.
This isn't a country album. So you've lost that exposure. But then you've gained more exposure with pop radio. But I think she probably, you know, I think the last album was a transition album. So, you know, We Are Never Ever Getting Back Together was a huge single, but maybe not quite as sort of pop shattering as Shake It Off. So I don't have the answer. If I had the answer, then I might, you know, be able to go to Vegas and make a lot of money, because then I'd tell the future. And, you know, but I mean, I think the reason is that it was the perfect storm, as you say, but that's kind of like sort of a, that's kind of like a fallback answer. Like, oh, it's the perfect storm. I'm like, well, yeah, she did everything right and it worked. You know, she had all the performances lined up. She did all the promotion that she's supposed to do. All of that worked. She stayed on message, and she really conveyed to the public and to her fans that this was an album that you wanted to experience, a full album that you needed to have. It wasn't just about songs. It was about the full album. And also, I think what was going for it was some little things that probably helped it to a certain degree. The fact that she had the Swift Stakes happening, where for every purchase of every album, there was a unique code inside the album that you could use to enter into a Swift Stakes. There's a playoff of sweepstakes.
Yeah.
Get it? Swift?
Sweep. I get it. Yeah.
where there were 1,989 prizes, including 250 meet and greets and tickets to concerts. So that probably helped move the needle a little bit. I think the collectability of the physical album itself prompted some sales, because there were five different sets of collectible Polaroid images inside each of the physical albums. And I think there were probably those that were passionate enough to want to buy multiple copies to get all of the collectible Polaroids. And you didn't know which set of Polaroids you were getting when you got the album, so sometimes you'd have to buy more than one to get them all. It's kind of like, you know, Pokemon, collect them all.
It is like Pokemon.
Gotta catch them all. And I think, you know, just the idea of having this sort of like conceptual piece, this 1989 piece. And I think that interested a lot of people, where, you know, they really wanted to hear this sort of sonic evolution of Taylor Swift. So I think it was a number of things that all combined. And also maybe to a certain degree, the fact that it wasn't on Spotify and streaming services, that could have helped sell a little bit more. I don't know how much that would have moved the needle entirely.
Yeah.
But I think all those things added up to some extra sales, but that number, I have no idea what it would be.
Yeah, no, I mean, going back to last week's podcast, I think you made a great point, which was that Taylor Swift convinced listeners that 1989 was an experience that they needed to own, that it wasn't just about Shake It Off or the next single, that this was an album, a project that you needed to experience in full, and you needed to, you know, whether it's through iTunes or, like you said, through Target with the deluxe edition or the physical copy with the Polaroids, she wanted people to experience this album. And looking at this number, which is the biggest sales week since 2002, I mean, this has got to be kind of encouraging. Everyone has spent the year talking about how horrible CD sales were, and they are horrible right now, but this still kind of shows that, you know, I saw people on Twitter, you know, as I'm sure you do as well.
The people on Twitter. Jason, what do they say?
The people on Twitter, you know, the trolls on Twitter, they're not even trolls, but the people that are just saying, this is going to be the last million seller for sure,
never
definitely.
Say
and
never.
And yeah, exactly. Because this proves that, you know, the fact that an album in 2014 by Taylor Swift can outsell an album in a Taylor Swift album from 2012 or 2010, it says that, you know, people are still listening to music, people are still paying attention, and if they want to buy an album, even if CDs aren't the future, that if they want to buy something and the product is crucial enough, they will buy it. It's interesting. I think it's kind of, like I said, I think it's encouraging for the industry. What do you think?
I think, you know, much like Beyonce's debut last December with her self-titled album, which surprised everyone and also delighted everyone with how well it sold, because it sold, you know, like a million copies in its first 10 days or something like that. You know, we can learn things from this. The industry can learn things from what Taylor has done with her album and the promotion of it and the conceptualizing of it. And the same thing that, you know, same way that we can learn about Beyonce and what to do from these two albums. How can we move forward and how can we sort of learn lessons from this and apply them to, you know, your own project? So
exactly.
I think artists and labels would behoove them to look at what Taylor did and what Beyonce did and say, how can we do not what they did, but how can we do something where we can appeal to our fan base and make something unique and highly desirable? Because it's it's not about trying to do the same thing. It's not about trying to do a surprise iTunes release. It's not about trying to do collectible Polaroids. You don't do that. That only works for you as a unique artist if it fits what's appropriate. And I think that's really what it comes down to. Like, every artist has to sort of super serve their fan base or to really create something that is enticing and desirable.
I think the word that I think of is indispensable. I think that these labels and these artists have to come up with a product that is seen as indispensable to fans, that they absolutely have to have it. There's no other. And again, going back to Beyonce, who we're going to get to in a second, that's what she did last year, because she released this album. Everyone online went crazy. You had to experience it through iTunes to watch all the videos. And yeah, it was essential that you spent some money and got this album. And like you said, this is a learning time for the industry. This is a time to reflect on 1989 and not the year, but the album. I mean, we can all reflect on the year 1989, but I think it's a time to, sit back and be like, what can we learn from this? I totally agree with you.
Yeah.
So, Keith, moving over to the Hot 100 to put a bow on our Taylor Swift discussion. Taylor, she can't be denied, because Shake It Off is now back at number one on the Hot 100. It's been a good week to be Taylor Swift right now, right?
Yeah, duh.
She also has 6 songs now on the Hot 100, thanks to the debut of 1989. We talked about that last week, how many songs, the number is 6. And her next single, Blank Space, already a top 20 hit. It debuts where does it debut? Number 19, number 18, somewhere right around there?
18. Don't hold me to that. You should check billboard.com on Thursday. I have the chart in front of me, but I'm not positive that position is correct, but I'm pretty sure it's 18.
Okay.
That sounds really sketchy, I realize. We know that number one is number one. Number 18, I think it's 18.
All right. We're still finalizing. That's how hot off the press.
We're finalizing things outside of the top 10 still. We're still working on the rest of the chart, but top 10, we definitely know.
Okay. Very cool, man. So congrats to Taylor. 1989, an amazing week. She's Billboard's Woman of the Year. Well deserved. And now she has the number one album and song in the country. Pretty mind boggling. So Keith, another superstar diva. Beyonce is coming back, kind of. So over the weekend, were you aware of this rumor that she was dropping a new album on November 14th? Were you aware of this kind of confirmation one sheet that was being passed along online?
Yes, I was aware.
With a fake track list. So here's the thing. So it's announced on Tuesday that it's not a new album coming out. It is a platinum edition box set of Beyonce, the album that came out in December, complete with 2 new songs, as well as 4 remixes, a couple of which have already been surfaced. And it's all being packaged with a live DVD and a DVD of all the music videos from Beyonce. And I think a mini calendar and more goodies. And so, Keith, before we talk about this, so will this deluxe edition be kind of bundled with the original album on the Billboard 200 chart? Is that how it's not going to count as something separate, right, on the album's chart?
Well, if her label wanted it to be separate, they could, but they want it to merge with the original album.
Okay.
And it can, because it falls within our guidelines of what can be merged. So when this box set comes out, you'll see there won't be any perceivable change on our charts. It'll just still say Beyonce, and then it'll just move back up the chart, presumably that week, once it comes out, with increased sales.
Very cool. I gotta say, man, I was like a little bit bummed when the rumor that there was a new album coming out got shot down, and then it was it was just a deluxe edition. And you know what? A great deluxe edition is great little stocking stuffer for fans. This is a pretty standard move. We talked about this yesterday. On GChat or AIM or whatever we use, but this is a pretty standard move for major artists, right? To kind of bundle a deluxe edition for the holidays.
Yeah, this isn't exactly, I mean, it's obviously interesting and cool, especially if you're a Beyonce fan, but this is kind of the norm
sure.
to reissue an album with bonus tracks or with extra goodies. I mean, the fact that she's adding a DVD with a concert, or at least most of her concert, it doesn't seem like it's the entire show, with what, like six bonus tracks or something. That's interesting, but not like, oh my God, earth shattering. It's cool, but not like amazing. It's great for the holidays. It's great for gift giving. It's great for Black Friday. It's great for Christmas. It's also great for physical retailers who got shut out initially with her iTunes album, who probably weren't exactly thrilled that iTunes got the exclusive on her album, you know, last December, and no one else had it physically for like a week.
Yeah.
So they were left in the dark on one of the biggest selling albums of the year. So now, you know, in time for Christmas, physical retail, especially around Christmas time and the holidays, will have a nice, fabulous Beyonce box set that would be lovely as a stocking stuffer or underneath someone's tree.
Yeah. And then here's the thing. I wrote about this on Tuesday about how it's okay to feel slightly disappointed that this is not a new album. Because here's the thing from our end over at Billboard. So we see these rumors going around over the weekend, and you know, we see that, oh, people are talking about a new Beyonce album coming out in a week and a half. So obviously we reach out to Beyonce's camp to either confirm or deny. And apparently there was this time period where we just didn't hear either a confirmation or denial. And so that we kind of had the feeling that something was coming. Because if, you know, this was just an internet hoax, which it turned out to be so, and nothing was coming, we'd get the word that says, no, nothing's coming, this is all a lie. But we get radio silence for a couple days, and then, you know, now something eventually did come. We get the Platinum Edition announcement on Tuesday morning. But that's kind of why we felt like, at least me, I felt a little bit like, oh man, maybe there is an actual new Beyonce album coming out. But alas, it's just, hey, two new songs, great, four remixes, awesome. But I feel your pain, those who thought this was a real thing and were slightly disappointed.
But that's anyway. Okay. It's all right.
That's okay. That's a thing.
It's all right.
I think, and like you said, this is a great thing for physical retail. You think of, you know, people shopping at Best Buy, at Target on Black Friday, they see this brand new Beyonce Platinum Edition with six new songs. They have to have it. They're Beyonce obsessives. And, I think, you know, we'll definitely see Beyonce album sales get a little bit of a boost around Black Friday, and thanks to this Platinum Edition. So, Keith,
yes,
the big release of this week, and I say big with air quotations. You can't see it because this is an audio podcast. I'm using air quotations to say big. Calvin Harris's Motion, his new album, the follow-up to 18 Months, is out. What is the sales projection for Calvin Harris's next album?
Industry forecasters, mind you, suggest the album could sell like, you know, 35,000 or so. I don't know if it's actually going to be the biggest debut this week, because I don't have forecasts on all the albums that came out this week or all the significant albums, because you still have things like Jake Miller has an EP, and there's a Joe Budden album.
Joe Budden.
Thank you.
Bette Midler.
Bette Midler. Well, Bette Midler is going to be less than Calvin Harris, but I think Calvin is one of the biggest ones. He could be the biggest debut. It's just sort of sad that, you know, we had this week and a whole lot of nothing came out. No offense to Calvin, but I mean, really, the album is
in
not
terms of sales.
Whole. In terms of
not,
sales,
not in, turn of,
not in terms of
artistic
yes,
creation.
No, it's obviously about things that could actually sell. And I was confused momentarily. I thought the Foo Fighters album came out this week, and it doesn't.
Yeah, that's next week.
Next week, and Pink Floyd has that new album, that sort of quasi-instrumental new album next week.
Yeah.
So it seems like everyone like purposely didn't put out really big stuff this week because they didn't want to get in the way of Taylor Swift's second week on the chart.
Yeah, pretty insane. I mean, when you look at Calvin Harris by now is basically a household name.
Well,
just because I think most people know who Calvin Harris is.
Nah.
Like, even if you're not a big like EDM watcher, I feel like he headlines festivals.
Nope.
You disagree?
Nope. Completely.
Really?
This is we're revisiting the Jesse J conversation from a few months ago.
Man.
A household name, Jason, is, and I say this with love, and you know I mean it like this in a nice way. A household name is Michael Jackson, Madonna, Taylor Swift, Beyonce. Calvin Harris, not a household name. Calvin Harris is known to like music fans, like big like music fans that pay attention to charts and pay attention to like what's popular on the top 10. But the average person, the average like mom and dad, have no idea who Calvin Harris is.
I don't know about that. I really don't know about that. I feel like if I walked up to someone on the street, and maybe I'll leave New York because I'm in New York.
Podcast man on the street. Do you know who Calvin Harris is? Maybe you would like cool parts of Manhattan or like, you know, like Brooklyn. But
no, you know what? I'm going to do this. The next time I'm home in South Jersey, I'm going to go to like, I don't know, the mall and be like, hey, do you guys know who Calvin Harris is? And everyone will be like, yeah, like maybe they won't be able to name more than one or two songs, but they'll know like We Found Love and like
We Found Love.
So
you say, have you heard
summer.
That song We Found Love? And oh, they're like, oh yeah, I know that. Do you know who Calvin Harris is? No, who is it? Oh,
all right.
That's
well,
song.
Anyway, Keith, I mean, he's not a household name in terms of Skrillex level. Would you believe that Skrillex is a household name? Would
no.
you give me that?
No.
Man,
I
want to get.
What
I want to get.
You're in, but the average American household probably can't even name who our Secretary of State is. How are they going to know who Skrillex is?
I feel like more people know who Skrillex is than our Secretary of State.
Mm.
Anyway, that's a commentary on. That's a little bit of political commentary for you on this post midterm election Pop Shop podcast, Keith. Anyway, okay, household name, not a household name. He is an electronic star. He is a festival headliner. And yet, this dude cannot sell albums. He is a live touring monster. And his tracks do great, right? I mean, Summer was a top 10 hit, and a lot of people lapped up that song, right?
Well, he makes tons of hits. Summer was a huge hit. He's a hit-making artist, and he's, you know, he has single after single that has been very successful. His last album, 18 Months. Generated, I don't know, what was it, like 7-8 different hit singles over like 2.5 years. I mean, it was huge. It was even bigger in the UK, I think. And obviously he brings down like, you know, millions and millions of dollars each year in touring. I mean, I don't have the exact number, but he's one of the highest paid DJs around the world. Yeah, he's huge when it comes to EDM and music and the DJ circuit and making hit singles. But in terms of being a household name with the average mom who knows who Taylor Swift is, no. No.
Well, all right. Well, maybe I'm not appealing to the soccer moms. Anyway, Keith.
I just like arguing with you, Jason.
I know you do.
You're sitting over there going, I want to kill him.
Anyway, but can we compare this? So you said that it's Motion, his new album. It has some huge collaborations on it. Ellie Goulding's back on this. Haim is back on this. But it's only going to sell probably, like you said, 35,000 copies in its first week. A fraction of something like Taylor Swift, of course. But even something like, you know, this is like a quarter of Ariana Grande or of, you know, other like pop stars. And my question is, can you compare this forecasted projected sales week with the first week sales of someone like Skrillex or Avicii or Deadmau5, like their last albums?
Yes.
How does Motion compare?
Of course I can do that because you asked me to prepare this for you before the show started. Skrillex's last album, Recess, did 47,000 in its first week. Avicii's last album did 50,000 in its first week, which is actually pretty good. And Deadmau5's last album, which I can't pronounce the title. I think it's While 1 Less Than 2, While 1 Carat 2 Opening to the Right, did 30,000. So again, all these artists are singles artists generally, though they would contend they're making a full album, obviously. But they were not able to communicate the idea of that this is a full album that you need to purchase, like Taylor, and on a really sort of wide, huge, massive scale, or like, say, Meghan Trainor or Ariana Grande. They're just very different artists, and they sort of live, you know, off the success of incredible hit singles and huge touring and that sort of thing. It's not about necessarily a full album purchase, clearly, for consumers, for them.
It's so interesting because it's almost like the argument of what's even the point of Calvin Harris putting out an album.
Like, why even bother doing an album? It's like, why would Pitbull put an album out when he's all about tracks? Like,
yeah, it's just interesting how some artists work like that. And obviously, and obviously there are some artists who are singles artists but still do decently in terms of albums. But you see an artist like Calvin Harris, and he has so many hits, and yet when he compiles them into an album format, it just doesn't connect with anybody. And it's crazy. Like, I remember reviewing Calvin Harris's last album, 18 Months, and I was like, man, there are so many hit singles on this. Like, there are songs on that album that you kind of forget were hit singles. There's just so many, like, they had that song Let's Go with Neo and I Need Your Love with Ellie Goulding. That was a bigger hit. But I mean, this is a hits-packed album, and yet people just don't buy it. It's interesting to me. And again, like you said, kind of in line with other EDM stars like Skrillex. Even if you don't think Skrillex is a household name, Skrillex is, you know, he was nominated for Best New Artist. Like, this guy is a huge name to a lot of people, and yet not many albums sold to date. Keith, my last question about Calvin Harris, would it have helped, do you think at all, if this album came out in the summer when the song Summer was doing so well? Do you think that moves the needle at all?
Nah. Probably not. Nah. I think it would have done what it's going to do no matter when it came out, unless it was like, you know, Thanksgiving week or like, you know, the week before Christmas when everything, all sales are just elevated. But nah, I doubt it.
All right. Well, there you go. So Calvin Harris probably not going to knock Taylor Swift
probably
off her
not
going to
topple Taylor second week. No,
probably not. Hey, you never know, man. Never know. So, Keith, we have a couple odds and ends to race through before the end of this show. First off, let's talk about Led Zeppelin, man. Hey, let's get the lead out. Led Zeppelin 4 is back in the top 10 of the Billboard 200 albums chart. So let's break this down, man. How did this happen?
So this is actually Led Zeppelin 4 and Led Zeppelin's Houses of the Holy were both reissued last week in fabulous deluxe reissue, standard edition, 2 CD edition, a box set, you know, many lavish creation. Anyway, both reissued. It is the 4th and 5th reissues in the Led Zeppelin reissue series that they've done. The first three were Led Zeppelin 1, 2, and 3. And Led Zeppelin 4, which is one of the biggest selling albums of all time, it is certified at 23 million units shipped, according to the Recording Industry Association of America. It returns to the top 10 on the Billboard 200 chart at number 7. Sold about 35,000 copies, up 3,042% in sales. Houses of the Holy comes back to the top 20 at number 12. Earlier this year, I think all three of the Led Zeppelin reissues, 1, 2, and 3, returned to the top 10. So clearly, yeah, this reissue series is working quite well for Led Zeppelin, but it's also fun just to see one of like the most classic albums of all time that never actually hit number 1, believe it or not. Led Zeppelin 4 peaked at number 2. It's just cool to see it back in the top 10 this week.
Yeah, and for those listening who, you know, might not be the hugest Led Zeppelin fans, Led Zeppelin 4 is their most iconic album, I would say.
Yes.
It's the one with Stairway to Heaven.
Yes.
It's the one with
Rock and Roll. And
Roll.
Yeah, it's
going to California. Like, if you want a gateway into Led Zeppelin,
that's
like
the one you get, yeah.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So, like you said, Led Zeppelin 4, House of the Holy, both reissued this week, and Led Zeppelin 4 does slightly better. Cool. I mean, Led Zeppelin, man, back in the top 10. Very cool. I wanted to ask you about this. I made a note. Imagine Dragons. They have their lead single from their next album, their pretty highly anticipated sophomore album. The single is called I Bet My Life. It has a big Mumford vibe on it. And it debuted in the top 10 of the digital songs chart this week. kind of a soft launch for this song,
kind of,
right?
Yeah, kind of. Yeah.
I expected more. I mean, after all of the success they had with Radioactive and Demons and, you know, a lot of interest in this band and this project, I bet my life doesn't, you know, maybe it'll grow, but it seems kind of soft. Were you kind of struck by that as well?
Well, I was initially surprised that the song, you know, didn't set the world on fire, yeah. As we often say.
Yeah.
I'm going to get the number in just a second for you. But I think when you think about it, though, Imagine Dragons was never like a big one-week type of band. You know, their album, Night Vision, started off at number 2 on the Billboard 200 and then spent, you know, like the next 2.5 years basically bopping around the top 20, top 40. And it was just very consistent. And their singles were performed really well over an extended amount of time. You know, none of them were just red hot for a second. They all built a very long life, a very long shelf life. And I think that can all be applied to the new single, which did 74,000 downloads in its first week. I think it's about building the song at radio and sort of reintroducing them, because, you know, they're not like, you know, Taylor Swift, where they're immediately like this huge media attention, you know, hogging type star. Like, you know, Imagine Dragons is still honestly a developing band that, while they had a huge album and a bunch of huge singles, I think they're still trying to sort of build a face and a name for themselves. And I think, you know, this is leading up to an album that will come out probably, I'm guessing, the first quarter of 2015. That's just a guess. No one's told me anything. So I think it's not about the first week for this. It's about building a story at radio, building a story with a single, and working towards the release of the album early next year.
It'll be interesting to keep an eye on it, because we talked about this song on the Must Hear Music podcast a couple weeks ago, or I guess last week when it came out, and how Imagine Dragons, there really haven't been that many breakout rock acts in the first half of the 2010s. That you could probably count them on one hand, and Imagine Dragons definitely one of them, so it'll be interesting to see where they go from here.
Yep.
I bet my life out now. So, Keith, my last question before we get to the charts out of the week, very quickly, the CMAs are Wednesday night. By the time you're listening to this, they will be over, but they're tonight as we are recording this. Is there such a thing as a CMA's bounce in
yes.
terms of single sales? So there is. Okay. So how big is that bounce? How does it compare to something like the Grammys?
Well, I mean, it's, you know, you're only specifically talking about one genre of music, but, you know, there can be very significant sales increases for albums, specifically songs as well. I happen to have last year's top country albums chart in front of me from the week after the CMAs. You know, Florida Georgia Line, their album jumped by 69%. Blake Shelton was up by 148%. Kacey Musgraves, which was, you know, sort of a big star that night, her album was up 567%. So, yeah, you can have really huge increases for country stars, especially those that kind of surprise people, you know, with a really sort of magical performance. You know, whoever is Entertainer of the Year usually gets a lot of shine.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I expect we're going to have a lot of big gains next week.
Very cool. So for those listening to this, pay attention to who did well at the CMAs on Wednesday night. And, hey, you never know. We might see big gains this week. So Keith, that's all I got, man. So let's do it, man. Your chart stat of the week.
Okay, so we're going slightly ahead of time, but then back in time for this week's chart stat of the week. On November 9th, 1985, Jan Hammer's Miami Vice theme hit number 1 on the Billboard Hot 100 chart.
Oh, yeah.
Boom, boom, boom.
Sugar, 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 sugar.
Before, there was TV shows like Grey's Anatomy and Glee propelling pop songs into the minds of TV watchers. There was Miami Vice back in the 1980s. The show blended MTV-style visuals and pop music, with dozens of acts lending their music to the show. Many acts even guest starred on the series, like Phil Collins, Sheena Easton, and Kiss's Gene Simmons. The series theme, written and performed by Hammer, became one of the few TV show theme songs to hit number 1 on the Hot 100 chart, and the first instrumental to top the list in more than 3 years. So there you go. There is your chart stat of the week. This week in 1985, Jan Hammer's Miami Vice theme hit number 1.
Love it, man. Love it. Thank you for your chart stat of the week. All right, Keith, that's going to do it for us here at the Pop Shop Podcast. Tune in next week. We'll have some more chart goodness. We'll talk about the Foo Fighters. I think we have some cool guests coming up on the Pop Shop Podcast in the next couple weeks, so I'm excited about that.
If you've been paying attention to us talking about Year of the Booty, you might be excited.
Oh, man, come on.
I'm not going to say. I'm just saying it's a hint.
Ah, come on.
That ruined it, didn't it? That ruined it?
No, it didn't. No, I hope people kind of guess. I have no idea if that's going to
be. They may guess the totally wrong thing now, because I can go anywhere, really.
That really could. Keith, do you have any parting words?
I do not.
Well, Keith, we went out on one of my favorite Taylor Swift songs last week. It only seems fair that we do your favorite Taylor Swift song. What do you want to hear to go out?
Oh, well, let's just do Out of the Woods.
Are we out of the woods yet? We are not. Are we out of the woods yet? Taylor Swift taking us out on the Pop Shop Podcast. Thanks for listening and take care.
With Lucky Land Slots, you can get lucky just about anywhere.
This is your captain speaking. We've got clear runway and the weather's fine, but we're just going to circle up here a while and get lucky. No, nothing like that. It's just these cash prizes add up quick. So I suggest you sit back, keep your tray table upright, and start getting lucky.
Play for free at LuckyLandSlots.com. Are you feeling lucky? No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus terms and conditions apply. See website for details.